Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Red Ice TV or Red Ice Radio, if you're listening to the radio version, very good to have you back again. My name is Henrik, and this is a new year. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here. It's excellent to have you here. We also have a new guest with us on the line, JF, and let's see if I can pronounce his name now. Jean-François Garipieux. Was it?
Yeah, very close. Garipieux.
There we go. Okay. Yeah, there's a last name there. I forgot about that. JF, good to have you here. I'm just going to call you JF for short, because it's easier that way.
Very happy to be here.
I started hearing about your work, obviously, after some of the Kraut drama. I didn't know about the guy. I didn't know what the big deal was until I found out that we were on a hit list of his. He had a little Discord server where he's going to take down all these, you know, YouTube channels and stuff, and I guess he has to put himself in line now when the British Parliament is actually talking about Red Ice as a source that they want to censor actively, at least in the UK. He's not first there by any means. But before we go into that and talk about some of that, tell us a bit about your background. What you're a biologist, of course. This drama began because you were actually been looking into the reality of race and whatnot. But how did you get into this?
Yeah, so I'm a biologist. At some point in my life, I got tired of brick-and-mortar academia, and I realized that YouTube was just a better platform to teach the way I wanted to teach. I wanted it to be both learning, but also entertaining. And I didn't feel like driving to a university every morning was the most efficient way to teach. And in fact, I've been proven right to myself every year that I continue my YouTube engagement. I gather more and more viewers in a way that would have been impossible in classical academia. So I'm really happy with what I've done. Now, finding myself on YouTube trying to teach stuff, race came as a subject because it's very emotional. People are very emotional about it, and because it's emotional, they make much more errors than they would if they were talking about frog legs or rat tails and its evolutionary origin.
True. But why is that, though? I mean, if you think about it, why should the biology of animals and plants and whatever else be different from human biology?
Well, it's because the facts of human biology have moral consequences that people hate. And people have difficulties not letting their moral preferences invade their investigation of facts, because they know very well that if you discover some facts, it will justify some actions. And they don't like this idea. And we live in an era of philosophical thought that has deceived people into thinking that facts and morals were somehow blurred, that one of them could help the other. And Sam Harris is one of the intellectuals who's been participating to what I consider to be a deceptive statement, this idea that morals can be demonstrated like facts, that moral statements are subject to true statements, is, in my view, false, and it's blurring the distinction between facts and morals.
Hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, there's several scientists that have kind of gone out against the norm, and they think, you know, just because they've started talking about this idea that, well, there are differences between races, that it's observable, it's genetic, whatever, they have gone kind of against the zeitgeist of this era. And they've been ousted out of science. They've been pushed out. They're not welcomed anymore. So I always seen that science itself, unfortunately, who were supposed to be an objective tool to try to get closer to reality and the truth, has become another didactic kind of political tool, really. Would you agree?
Yeah. And the investigation of fact right now in academia is subject to huge taboos. And people don't understand this when they have this infinite respect for scientists and they say, oh, if that's true, why don't scientists talk about it? There are multiple reasons why a scientist would not engage on controversial subjects. Race is one of the best examples. They can get fired. They can get they can have difficulties justifying their funding. And ultimately, because all of science relies on other scientists agreeing with your work, of course, scientists are not bent toward controversial subjects. They know very well that there are subjects that are not safe to talk about. Personally, I've freed myself from such oppression, if you want to call it that, because I don't rely on any funding from governments. And so my works are theoretical, they are made at home, and I enjoy that life so much because I can really be interested in looking for the truth without being interested in what my colleagues would think about it.
Yeah, and people should know too. No one is safe, no matter how high up you are in the ranks, right? Remember Watson, one of the guys who behind discovering the DNA, the form and shape and stuff like that, James Watson. And I think I forget exactly what his statement was, but it was basically linking intelligence to race, I believe. Yeah. And due to that, he'd been ostracized. He's actually doing so bad financially that he was forced to sell his Nobel Prize. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, there's this guy, there's Tim Hunt, who did a joke about female scientists, and he got fired. So we are faced with political correctness invading the search for truth. And these are two great examples that no one is protected. Even the highest grade scientists can be kicked out by social justice warriors.
That's right. They've fallen from grace. They're no longer acceptable. And these are guys that basically have remained, I would say, largely. They haven't really, I wouldn't say that they have never changed their position. They've just stood firm in what they've believed. And then the narrative itself, the spectrum of what's acceptable has moved so far to the left that they are now seen as, I don't know, some extreme right-wing kind of people when they're really not, you know?
Yeah, society has evolved around science, and it has evolved around a main scientific discourse that, as you say, has always remained the same. I mean, if you were interested in the truth 50 years ago, you're still interested in the truth today. But we live in a society that has justified invasions of the search for truth for moral crusades. And that is very worrying. And Kraut, you were mentioning Kraut, why I got involved in this story. Kraut is a YouTuber who we literally busted his Discord by having spies in. And it was clear that this person was starting to be involved in smearing individuals who were having positions that he believed were wrong, so people on the right. And he was getting ready to dox these people, to use private information against them, to smear them. And in fact, even if Kraut was busted and was found doing it, and he left the internet as a result of being exposed for this plan, his effort continues today. And today there are people making false claims against people who are on the right, or even sometimes on the center right, like Coach Red Pill, who's a YouTuber, who's not really a right-wing extremist. And they are getting smeared, and I'm getting smeared too, as a result of the efforts of Kraut and his colleagues to just, because we cannot win the scientific argument and we cannot win the moral argument, we're just going to claim that these people are pedophiles and rapists. Based on totally false allegations.
Is that the charges that they're coming with?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been attacked by colleagues of Kraut for being a pedophile, as they claim it, and a rapist and an abductor of mentally ill people. And yet, I've never been in prison. I've never been in jail. Never been found guilty of any of these crimes. But they will take audios. They will misinterpret them, audios that they've caused themselves. For example, they will come on my stream and ask me to justify from an evolutionary perspective, why would old men be interested in young people? And so, of course, I give them the biological explanation. And now they go out there and they say, oh, we proved that JF is a pedophile. I mean, that's what they're down to. And that's why it made such a big scandal. It's not that one troll on the internet was doing it, is that one of the biggest YouTuber on the left was engaging in high coordination activity with up to 50 people for doing this kind of smearing.
What's at the root of this, Dan? I mean, is it that the so-called skeptic, the bubble that these people are in, have they been losing people? Because, I mean, they were kind of engaging in this, debunking ventures, right? The one topic after another, this here, that there. And it's okay. I mean, I'm all for getting to the truth, and that's what this show always has been about. We talk about the topics that we do talk about because we believe those are truthful, and those are the important topics at this particular time that needs and deserves focus, especially those that the mainstream doesn't cover, even more important to highlight those. But that it seems, and correct me if I'm wrong, but was it that some of these skeptics began, I guess, the skeptic community was losing people to race realism when they started looking into that as an area to attack, so to speak, and debunk?
Those are very complex hypotheses, so I wouldn't reject yours. I have my little pet theory about what happened there. I think that the probably multiple theories are valid to explain the rift that has divided here. Yes, certainly, alt-right speakers have become more and more popular on YouTube for the last few years. They've reached some sort of a mainstream prominence, although not mainstream view counts. But I mean, just the fact that Hillary Clinton would mention them in her speech, it's a sort of prominence to be recognized as an enemy by the Democrats is something. So I think that, yes, there is the fact that some viewer counts were being driven toward the alt-right created a sort of jealousy in the skeptic community. But I also think that the skeptic community has internal contradiction about what it's interested to do. So people in the skeptic community, if you take their statement, their stated aim, it is to find the truth. It is to combat denial, combat deception. Now, if you do that with highly religious extremists who make false claims, false factual claims, it's pretty easy because you're facing an opponent who's not even engaged in the search for truth. Now, if you're facing people like the alt-right YouTubers that these people were after, you are against a bunch of people who have their entire lives devoted to responding to you, debunking you, addressing your arguments with actual philosophically valid arguments. So you're dealing with a very different bunch of people. And I think that's the difficulty they face. We are faced with alt-righters who are intelligent, who have scientific literacy, who can develop philosophically valid arguments. And yet the left in our societies has always been winning for the last 40 years. Has always been winning by silencing their opponent, by not having the discussion. But now the internet has emerged and you're forced to have that discussion because you can make your leftist video all you want and you can deny factual reality all you want. You're going to get 10 or 15 response videos. So either you will engage in a live stream debate where you're going to face your opponent and you're going to be ridiculed if you state false stuff, or you're going to have so many response videos that it's going to be it's going to be the equivalent of a discussion. That's what the internet allowed, and I think that's the kind of friction that they were not ready to handle.
So what do you think is the right approach to this here, then? Because obviously many on the left and many of the established platforms itself are now beginning to kick out people because they dare to ask these questions. I mean, I believe that the first video on YouTube that was placed in this quarantine mode was a video on race and IQ by Jared Taylor from American Renaissance, right? Many have followed. We have now had, I don't know, probably 20 videos, I think, put in that state, and it continues, and they've employed a 10,000-strong team that basically is going to do the enforcement of you know, thought crime kind of topics and forbidden areas and stuff like that. I always thought they're not going to win doing those things. I don't think they even know what they're getting themselves into by doing this. I think it will be an attractiveness to those topics even more that will draw people in even further. And sure, that's great as far as I'm concerned. I mean, clearly it must be that they don't want to engage because they know that they're not going to win the debate, right? Isn't it that simple?
Yeah, and my specialty, that's essentially what I've been trying to do for a year and what I will try to continue doing, is to debunk the ridiculous claim that the right is wrong on the facts. Because at this point, we have right-wing speakers who are extremely agile at arguing facts and at doing it correctly. And we are not wrong on scientific grounds, or we are not totally deluded. So I'm trying to say to the left, you're going to have to engage on an actual moral discussion with us, and you're going to have to state your moral preferences. Not assume that we're ridiculous, not assume that we're stupid, not assume that we got the science wrong, because there was one guy who tried this. His name was Kraut, and he was so ashamed by what he had done that he deleted his entire video history or privatized it on YouTube. He has closed his channel and disappeared from the internet. So don't do like Kraut. Engage with us on the actual philosophical question of what is the correct way to organize our society in terms of racial diversity, in terms of cultural diversity. Let's have a true moral discussion for the first time in this entire thing.
This channel has no videos. Yeah, there you go. So that's what happens, I guess. Well, I mean, it deserves him right then if he's peddling around with these Discord groups trying to get people censored and shut down. That's just absolutely ridiculous.
And it's important to understand, Kraut and T, we didn't bully him off the internet. This is a leftist who has done things that were so wrong in the way he produced videos and in the way he attacked people personally that he self-shamed out of the internet. This is not someone we've harassed. This is not someone we've bombarded with threats. This is someone who has realized how wrong he was. And he was so ashamed that he could not tolerate be present on the internet anymore. That's what happens when you follow an extremist agenda. That's not even extremist in the sense of leftism, because he was pretty much at the center left. But that's what happens when you reach a form of radicalization that is so extreme that you're willing to not argue on the facts, not argue on the morals, but just smear your opponents until they are intimidated away from the internet. It won't work anymore.
Did he... I haven't followed his channel. I don't know much about him. But someone said he did kind of anti-SJW videos in the beginning, more or less. Was he kind of from that kind of Sargon kind of environment? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the amazing thing with Kraut. He had internal contradictions, too. He was an anti-SJW, but he was a liberal centrist, in the same way Sargon was. He was a little more on the left, especially on the question of cultural diversity and races. I guess that was his main difference with Sargon. He was an active fighter against the idea of race, and he believed in the dogma of the left there, that people of any race are all the same, and if they integrate to a society, it's all good, and that they can be integrated through some sort of cultural integration.
Well, his Patreon is still up. $392 per video. Yeah. Something. No, but so he came from that environment. He was kind of attacking SJWs and stuff like that. Do you know what flipped and switched? There was this Rage of the Storm, Rage After the Storm. This girl, she did a video on race realism and stuff like that, and that seemed to have kind of a lot of things kind of fell apart after that. I don't know. Were you part of this community at that time, or debunking them or anything like that?
I was part of the community, but I was not paying any attention to Kraut. As far as the explanation of what happens, Kraut, because I've had talks with him since then, since he left the internet, and even Kraut himself at this point doesn't know where he went wrong. But he believes it happened somewhere around 1 year ago, where he started being extremely vile against the right wing. And what I think happened there is he has gone through the process that many radical extremists on the left go to convince themselves that their political opponents are Nazis, that their political opponents are the most evil force and that they need to be fought against with any means. We can see it on his Twitter. He was starting to visit World War II museum and dehumanizing the people involved, really hating Nazis to a point where it's not relevant in 2018 to be that pissed off against a group. And I think that what happened in his head is he went into a crusade and he thought he was on such a moral high ground that nothing he could do against right-wing people was unfair.
Yeah, so that's a good point. In the beginning, we were talking about the fact that many scientists, many in the establishment, they withhold or prevent or even suppress information that seems to lead to, for example, the pointing towards the reality of race, because they believe at the end of that road is a moral question, which is far worse than dealing with the actual reality of the biology itself, right? So they think, or they assume, in my opinion, that just because you did take the reality of race into your worldview, so to speak, and accepted that somehow that will lead to, extermination of humans, or it will lead to concentration camps and all these kinds of things. I mean, there's not really a way that you can prove that to these people, that it's not going to, but they shouldn't assume that people who are interested in the reality of race are going to build concentration camps. That's kind of that's a false assumption, obviously.
Yeah, and this false assumption is grounded in a principle that to me resembles, and it's a parallel, it's not a perfect resemblance, but it resembles escalations of violence. You know when a little hit justifies a greater hit on the other side, and then the other side says, oh, I need to protect myself, this guy is too violent, and then he goes with a bigger hit. This kind of escalation of violence is a little bit what's happening when people escalate deception. When people say, oh, well, if I find that fact, I'm going to have moral consequences in my moral framework. Therefore, I should keep everyone around me from finding that fact. And in fact, if they are interested in finding that factual reality, they are pursuing the moral goal that I perceive in them. You have an escalation where, okay, people now start censoring themselves and they start censoring others on their quest for truth and quest for investigation of the world. Now others are justified in replying to this, saying, hey, I'm just a free individual trying to gather facts in the world, and you are accusing me of being an evil person and having moral goals that I do not have just because I engage in this search for truth. And you have what really leads to eventually an escalation of violence, because people are free to know what they want to know about the world and to engage in this search for truth without being attributed intents that they don't have.
Yeah, see, this is an interesting point. I mean, this is the very premise that organizations like Antifa is operating out of, right? That they, in their action, they are actually, it's a moral act because they are preventing, at the end of the day, violence, right? They think, you know, if you're on the right, people like me and probably you too, that we are fascists, we are Nazis. But basically, if we gain any power or anything, we're going to start mass murdering people. So therefore, it's a moral imperative that they actually, with violence, stop us. Without realizing in that same process, if our immoral act is to commit violence, right? They are hating us because we are committing the wrong act of our actions leading to violence. So that should enable them to understand that, well, wait a minute, now you're committing the violence first to try to stop violence. In other words, they've engaged in a behavior that would cause us to say, well, you're actually violent. We actually haven't initiated violence. You have initiated violence because you think you're stopping violence, but that puts us in a position where we can actually, with violence, defend ourselves because you're violent. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and this is something I've seen as a cognitive psychologist interested in questions of violence. Human violence is always grounded in the perception that the other deserves violence. Every abuser will tell you that what they did was not so bad because they were in a context where the other was also committing acts of violence against them. And I think it boils down to back to the principle of libertarianism, which is the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle is a principle that looks at who initiates force, because the person who initiates force then justifies the other to act in self-defense and to continue the use of force. And what we need to be interested in is who is making the first act of violence that is not explained or not deserved, not explained through self-defense. And in the case of the Antifa protesters you present, it is evident that they are attributing false intent to people on the right. And I'm starting to think that attribution of false intent and strawmanning and misrepresentation of others, I'm starting more and more to think that it is in and of itself an act of violence. Even if it's not the way we use the term usually, I believe it is violent to attribute something to someone that they didn't do.
Right, exactly. Because, I mean, from their point of view, it could... I don't know. I'm trying to really just kind of understand how they're thinking, to be honest, and how the reasoning, how they come to this position. Do they think that it's a violent act to admit differences, for example, that the egalitarian, that they're striving so much for an egalitarian point of view, that if you come with evidence or even claims that this worldview is not true, that there exists inequality in the world, that we are not the same, there are differences. I don't see that as a problem, but apparently they do. And that's enough for them to, like, lash out and violently shut down these people.
I think that essentially they are missing, I think that's something that a lot of extremists are missing, both on the left and on the right. It's an understanding that there is a difference between morals and facts, and that there are chains of consequences between facts and morals that are not to be reproached to the person who discovers the fact. Just like I wouldn't reproach the inventors of the nuclear bomb, or of even the principles of physics that allow us to create nuclear bombs, I would not hold them personally responsible for the bombing of a country by a nuclear bomb. And in the same way, you should not reproach to someone who discovers, I don't know, differences of IQ between races. You should not reproach these people for the moral consequences that may emerge in societies. And as far as the moral consequences that may emerge in societies, I will say some of them are bad, but some of them are good. Knowing that people are different and possibly agreeing on these differences and organizing a world in which these differences can exist in some harmonious context is really not a bad goal in my view.
Yeah.
I think we could recognize the differences between cultures and race and say, all right, some of these differences will allow us to live in the same town, but some may not. And so let's make different countries for people and let's make different towns or whatever it is that people converge to. What's important is that, one, we don't deceive people on the reality of the differences between humans. And
yeah.
Two, we let people respectfully organize a world that will be better for everyone.
Exactly. I agree with that. I think it's far worse to reject reality and the truth and try to construct a false narrative around that, because that will not last. We've seen that historically, that you know, the truth is going to get out, things are not going to work, and that's why you constantly have to have a society where you're micromanaging everyone, right? You have to, you know, it's not about equality anymore, it's equity, right? That you have to, if someone strives a little higher, you need to go in and literally manage them so that they don't achieve as high, right? You need to cut them down, or you need to take, whether it's wealth or ability from them and give it to other people. I mean, it just doesn't work in the long. It sows discontent and jealousy and all these weird things, and that's just not going to lead to anything good. And I mean, I come from that perspective too. I think that trying to create a multicultural, some utopia is just it's a pipe dream. It's just not going to work. And it's better that we're honest about that now and talk about the reality of what actually is going to work, as opposed to try to create a world which is not feasible, and in the process have an incredible amount of hurt and violence and damage and misery done in the wake of this multicultural utopia of the elitists, you know?
Yeah, and on the multicultural utopia, we've been letting Western civilization invite people in our countries that have global interests. And I'm thinking specifically about, for example, the Muslim religion. When you are a Muslim in Canada, you vote for interests that are not merely concerning your Canadian network and your Canadian life. You are in Canada, but you have a solidarity with other people of the same religion that you are in every other country of the world. We cannot expect realistically that someone with such an attachment to a global group will always vote in the interest of Canada in the same way a Canadian would.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And before we move on and talk more about that, let's stick on that rather a little bit and talk about that. Quebec, of course, have always been very, you know, kind of for self-determination. There has been, I think, attempts in the past to separate from the Canadian Commonwealth and stuff like that. How are you on that front, so to speak? And how are things going there? I don't hear too much. I mean, obviously, due to the language, they've always kind of seen themselves a little bit separate too. But are you part of that movement, if you will? Would you like to see a separation from Canada?
Absolutely. I've always been a separatist for Quebec. We've tried two times. We had two referendums. The first lost, it was 40% yes. The second, that was in 1980. And then in 1995, we had a referendum. We lost again, but it was 49.4% yes. Currently, there is not much hope that it will ever happen, because we think that the 1995 chance that we had was the best chance given the demographics and the evolution of the immigration situation.
Mm-hmm.
We've let so many people in at this point, and it's not so much us. It's the Canadian government is controlling immigration in part. The Quebec has their word, but it's essentially we've been flooded with people who will not be interested in Quebec separation.
Yeah.
And so the possibility that a kind of Quebecois ethnostate will see the day is pretty much less. And personally, I consider the Quebecois people as chosen its own death, and that within the next 500 to 1,000 years, our culture will be completely disappeared, and our genes will probably also disappear not so long after, because at this point we've invited so much immigrants in that have much higher birth rates. At this point, we are too liberal. We've given up too much religious values that were somewhat protecting us from antinatal discourse and antinatalist policies of the government. I think we've signed our own deaths for the next 1,000 years at least.
Absolutely horrible. I don't know how anyone can be against self-determination and ultimately diversity too. I mean, France is bad in itself, so even the origin place where the Quebecois came from is also being flooded. I mean, they don't have a homeland to return to anymore either, you know? So it's almost like that you guys over there almost probably more pure French, even at this point, than the French are at this point. You know, it's horrible all over. And I mean, anyone who is for human biodiversity should be very concerned with these questions, because, I mean, with all their talk of diversity and, you know, difference and all that kind of stuff, as we know, and this is kind of such an obvious point, it's almost like a cliche, but multiculturalism destroys diversity. And it's so obvious. And talk to us, if you can, then, from a biologist point of view, in terms of the argument for diversity, why that is good to have in the gene pool, why there should be kind of a, and I know it's difficult with travel and with the fact that we have the internet and stuff, and I believe we're right now historically at a point where obviously you wouldn't be able to stop people from traveling or meeting other people from other parts of the world. And so, sure, there is some level of organic activity there, but that's not the same as relocating millions of people from third world and second world countries that are completely from incompatible cultures, placing them in the West or in first world countries, millions of people in some cases. And in some cases, they do integrate. In other cases, they remain very much a separate kind of a society within the society and very much for their own. They push their own interests. They, as you said, have higher maybe birth rates and stuff like that. But there's many problems that come with that kind of thing. But what would you say as a biologist in terms of the issue of diversity?
Well, as a biologist, it's heartbreaking to see a people vote for its own inexistence the way my people did. Because as a biologist, you know that every life form that doesn't want to live will disappear. That the only life forms that survive are those who eagerly and continuously throughout their life do everything they can to survive and reproduce. That's what evolution does. Evolution keeps those that want to survive. And unfortunately, the French people didn't want to survive, and the Quebecois people didn't want to survive. Now, as far as multiculturalism goes, I think we need to start addressing the left, and the multicultural left, and we need to explain to them that we're not the only one. It's not only the alt-righters who want an ethno-state. They want an ethno-state too, the leftists, the multicultural people. They want an ethno-state, but we just don't agree on the ethnicity.
Yeah.
The ethno-state that they want is the big racial Canadian mix, if you will, with 5% of Sikh Indian genes, 5% of Muslim genes from Africa, 5% of South African black genes. That is an ethnic and racial policy. Even if you don't call it that, even if you want to seem all open and not want to engage on the details, I'm sorry, but what your current immigration policy is a racial mixing policy, even if you don't know it. And I think it starts to call people on the left out and say, why do you think that your ethnostate is better than my ethnostate?
Yeah, exactly. It's a good point. Can you motivate from a biologist point of view, from a scientific point of view, that it's actually also better for? I mean, we know what happens with monocultures when it comes to crops, for example, and we know that when there are diseases or even temperature changes, things that occur in the environment, that can actually upset the whole crop at that point. Instead of having genetic diversity, it leads you to a point where you have better resistance against unforeseen variables in that picture. And I would assume that it's the same when it comes to humans.
Yeah, I think biodiversity is a strength for unpredictable environments. And so I guess you could make an argument there. I usually don't make it, because ultimately I'm not a guy who uses facts to justify morals. I prefer,
right.
having the balls to stand for my morals and say, look, the facts are in a certain way, but it's not an experiment in a glass cylinder that's going to tell you how to raise your kid.
You're right.
So I like to be straight on it, but I do have a sentence from a Jewish philosopher. I forget his name. He was an anthropologist, and he was saying something along the lines of, the greater moments in human civilization were those where people were separate enough to be different, but close enough to communicate these differences and exchange the knowledge that they had developed on their own. And that would be my view of human civilization and of the optimal point to reach. It's not a biological view, although it may have biological consequence, because you're right, biodiversity would allow us to survive environments that we cannot predict today. But most importantly, the development of ideas in human civilization relies on our differences. And there are stuff that we wouldn't have discovered if we weren't Canadian, if we weren't Americans, if we weren't brought up in a certain culture. And certainly art and cinema are huge examples where the uniqueness of your culture will eventually impact your product. And I think we need to maintain those differences in the world if we don't want an homogeneous culture across the globe.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you're right. I think we should not have to prove it scientifically. And even if I was wrong, right, I think I've actually heard some geneticists talk about, well, no, and they've been pushing this for a while, actually, that no, you're superior. I've seen articles like that. Win, you know, let your child win the genetic lottery, maybe, because you need to like mix with like an African and an Asian or something, right? And they claim that this is actually better. There's several authors. I did a video about that a while back, or one of the Weekend Warrior shows. I talked about this one author. That, I forget the title, but it was basically like better mixed. Like we'll create better humans if we're mixed, you know. But even if my point is, even if that was true, which I don't think it is, I would still stand up for the right of my own people to exist as a unique group in the world, and them having self-determination, even if I was wrong, you know?
Absolutely. That's why I don't make the argument for diversity, because you can use it both ways.
Yeah.
You can say, oh, well, you want diversity at the national level. Why don't you want diversity in your city so you can reproduce with these diverse people and win their genes?
Right.
But the counter-argument to this, of course, is, well, you don't have to abandon your genes to something that reproduces more than you. You can make the world for people like you. That's what we've been doing throughout our evolutionary history. When we built houses, we made a world that was favoring people who were weaker as it relates to our response to temperature. In fact, if you take a modern human, you put it in a jungle, you won't survive for a long time.
No.
Because we've evolved away from this, and we've chosen the world to be in a certain way. We can choose the world to be for our people, for our descendants. We can make these choices, and it's not a glass cylinder that will tell you how you should want the world. Now, someone on my chat is specifying the philosopher I was quoting is Claude Lévi-Strauss. He's right. Mm-hmm. Now I remember.
Right. Cool. Yeah. That's very interesting, you know, because it's like, yeah, it's not a lab experiment. This is the real world. It's a very different kind of environment, but there are people that are advocating for this or are pushing this rather. I mean, it's not that we have to, how do I put this? We don't have to scour into the darkness to find a deep secret conspiracy of people that are trying to create a homogenous race of people on the planet. They're quite open about it. I mean, there's politicians, there's business people, there are academicians, there's all kinds of people from different walks of life that are, for different reasons perhaps, at those different times, saying that, you know, we have to do this, right? I mean, it's like, We have one video that we call the War on Whites, which is like a promo video on our YouTube channel, and in there we don't say a single word. All we've done is to take from the horse's mouth, as they say, and showed how all these different people, politicians in Europe, business people, politicians in America, other activists who are doing different things, they're all talking about how like there can be no racially homogenous nation on the planet anymore. There's EU politicians talking about this, and I still don't know quite their motivation, what it is. I don't think they're pushing this because they think will be more superior biologically. There's other reasons for why they do that, but my point is, it's not something that people who are skeptical to what we're talking about can deny. These are quotes. We have them. You can show them to people, and you can see that they have a very strong motivation behind making sure what I think primarily is Europeans to become extinct or become minorities in our own countries. What do you make of this? Why did they push this?
Yeah, I mean, and these points, they get ridiculed as being, oh, you're pushing the theory of white genocide. How ridiculous is that? I'm engaging with people on the left more and more, and I'm engaging with the portion that's willing to interact with me more and more, and that's willing to engage in an honest conversation, and I can guarantee to you that there are a lot of people on the left and in the center that are consciously wanting white people to disappear. Of course, they will not call it white genocide, but they find that there is something wrong with white people reproducing. And you just go look at the Twitter of Jessie NYC. She literally says, if you are a white person making white babies and caring for these white babies to get the best from the world, you are part of the problem. And yeah. I had Destiny earlier on a stream, on the Warski live stream, saying that because I had impregnated, I was looking to impregnate my fiancé. We were having a project of having a baby. And he called that baby damage. For these people, white babies are damage to the world. It's something that we shouldn't do, and it's something that makes the world worse. And so I'm sorry I have to use the term white genocide to represent this, but it's literally what we're faced with in terms of argument. These people are literally saying it on Twitter. What am I supposed to do? I would love reality to be much more nuanced, and I would love to argue on a more nuanced level, but that's what they tell us they want.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And they can be very open about it. And they're not getting censored. I mean, this is a kind of a side issue here, but, you know, they're not being silenced. It's not being seen as some big immoral action on their part of doing these things and saying these things. The simplest tool, weapon in our arsenal that we have is to simply flip those arguments and say, if you would have said this about black people or about Asians or about Jews or any other Amish, whatever, the Dutch, any other group, then you would basically, you'd be shut down, you'd be fired, you'd be booted off, you'd be socially ostracized. It's almost like that there is a cultural narrative that's been running for such a long time, that even people who would denounce these statements if it was regarding other people, other races, they just don't see it for white people. It's become a moral imperative that they shut white people down and make sure that we don't exist, because that is what's going to lead to a world of peace. It's going to be, you know, because any other thing is white supremacy, supposedly, right? So that's the big boogeyman in the room, that us existing, us having self-determination, is white supremacy, and we've learned now through, you know, 40 years of Hollywood programming that's the worst thing ever. I mean, it's very difficult to fight these people to a certain extent and make them see their own behavior when they're just so deeply programmed on a moral level, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I think what we need to do there is we need to make the left explode, because I'm convinced that there are lots of people on the left who are a little bit like I was when I was on the left. They are just opened to diversity, and they would not stand behind the statements of Jesse NYC on Twitter. They would not say whites need to be to stop reproduction. And so I think we need to cater to these people and say, look, you might want to join our side of the political discourse, because we are against this. We are for the maintenance of biodiversity on Earth, which includes white heterosexual people. It's as simple as this. We need to push this message forward and show to these people, look at what the people on your side of the political discourse want. Do you really want to be on their side?
Yeah, here's the article. Exactly. There's so many of these now, JF, you know, that I can't even keep track of them all. The other professor, remember, he was fired just a few days ago, finally, after everything, right? All I want for Christmas is white genocide or something like that, he said. you know, it's just like, they continue to come out. There is some pushback now, though, finally. there, you know, some of these stories make the news. Some of the, there was this other article I was showing, a nurse, and this is, I mean, this is scary stuff. There's a nurse, a black nurse, who's talking about that the little, the white babies that she basically has helped to deliver needs to be sacrificed. And I mean, and these people are convinced morally that they are doing the right thing. Now, who's do you have any, talk to us a bit about who you think is pushing this and exactly why?
I think that it starts with dehumanization. So these people are being pushed in a narrative where, in fact, it's what you name, it's the fear of white supremacy. There are interests in our societies that don't like the idea that that our societies would be for white people and by white people. And the sum of these interests regroup a lot of different kinds of people. So it includes people who are part of minorities. It includes people who are white people, but they're just on the left, and they don't like the idea of being in the dominant group. So they like this idea of diversifying the group so much that their leftist views will take over eventually. There are people who are Jewish people who don't like the idea of having white nationalists take over the countries that they're part of. There's lots of interest in that play in there. But ultimately, what you have is dehumanization and the conviction, as you said, that what these people are fighting against is white supremacy. And it's exactly what happened to Kraut, and it's exactly what happened to any radical. You end up being convinced that you're fighting an enemy that is so wrong that even killing him would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the root of all violence in humans.
But what's funny here about this too, then, JF, is that we are being attacked, if you will, or charged with these accusations because they believe our actions is going to lead to violence and genocide. But they're actually engaged in it. They're actually out there promoting it vocally. We're not. I mean, I know that they think that, well, we're just putting on this show, and we're just trying to look nice and respectable, and or, you know, like Lana, my wife, she's like, well, I've seen articles where like she's faking that she's happy and smiley and stuff like that. It's just a front, right? An act, a show, because at the end of the day, we just want to build concentration camps and murder people, right? So, I mean, I don't know how to convince them otherwise beyond just continuing telling them the truth and actually showing who we really are. And what we actually want, and talk about that. But what I'm saying is that according to their own standards, we should be able to defend ourselves and actually actively make sure that these people are under control, right? And are not able to follow through on their agenda, right?
Yeah, and of course, the only thing that can get you out of this is logic. It's logical processing of realizing, oh, I'm holding beliefs right now that are self-contradictory. Unfortunately, I'm a French nihilist, and I have very little hope that we can change humanity through logic and through reflection about philosophical contradiction. I believe that the world is headed toward this situation getting worse and worse, up to violence eventually.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sad thing. I would wish it to be another way. But the fact is that humans don't evolve to process logical statements and to adhere to consistent beliefs. People evolve because in certain situations they make more babies. And right now our countries are favoring somewhat leftist thinking and center thinking that are willing to enact social welfare policies that help them reproduce. And there is no clear direction that our society is taking away from the situation that we describe. On top of it, we invite more immigrants in that have higher birth rates. And so it seems that the next generation, we will have more of the people that we have today making even more babies, being driven toward irrational beliefs such as those of the left today or those of the religions, which in my view are all false and all drive toward forms of extremism. So I think that the situation we have painted here is going to get worse as the years go by.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't know a way out of it. I've been trying to argue with people who don't agree with me on some of these issues that, you know, I am actually trying to stop violence. I don't want to see violence on the basis of lack of resources, for example, or ethnic groups within European countries kind of violently going after each other, because that's what it's going to lead to. We saw the examples in the 90s in the Balkans, for example, horrible wars and stuff like that. You had intervention there, and you had NATO going in and bombing those people. It looks more and more like that they were simply just defending themselves from attacks and stuff like that. I mean, I don't understand who anybody would want to try to avoid that situation and say, you know, if this, and we're back to again to the reality of biology that most people, not everyone, but most people, they tend to favor their own. They tend to group among, you know, their own people. They feel most at home there. It's not a cultural, problem that they have to overcome with these people. There's no language barrier. So it's just easier. I mean, humans tend to take the path of least resistance. And in this case, just being with your own people is that's the path of least resistance. But it will lead to violence. It will lead to conflict. And we're trying to stop that. And we have to make these people understand that no, what you're advocating for is going to lead to a Europe in a civil war state, and probably America and Canada too at some point. Do you think they just think, well, this is, it's going to go away, or it's a price worth paying? Because at the end of that, it's actually better. I mean, Robert Putnam, who did some studies of social cohesion, he kind of came to the same conclusion that actually, it's horrible. Diversity is horrible for social cohesion. People tend to stay home more. They sit in front of the TV. They become basically more absorbed with consumerism as opposed to, you know, building networks with other humans and having friends and stuff like that. But he literally said in some of his interviews, yes, it's horrible now, but at the end of that, like in two, three generations down the road, then it will be better. Is that a justification, do you think, for them?
I think that there's lots of cells in the left. I think that there's a part of the left that are closet anarchists, and they want to bring people in because they're totally fine with eventually getting enough poor people in the country to get a revolution, and they really want to destroy Western civilization. I think that's not that's a significant portion of the left, unfortunately, in my view. Now, there are also leftists who simply, they won't think about the time scales that you mentioned. There are people who don't really care about 1,000 years from now, 100 years from now. And I think that's something that we can work on. We cannot convince the closet anarchist that he should not destroy Western civilization. He's happy with this.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Let's give up these people. But there's another bunch of people who are merely not thinking of things in terms of thousands of years. That's something we can fix. We can start having a discussion about evolutionary principles, about what happens over thousands of years to life forms. We know what happens. They get selected based on the number of babies they do. And whoever today you see make 2.5 or 3 babies per couple versus those who make only 1 or 1.5 babies, in 1,000 years from now, the whole society will be made of the people who make 3 babies per couple.
Yeah.
And what is it right now? It's Muslims that are making 3.3 babies per couple across the globe. And so if you want an image of future, just consider that making 3 babies per couple is enough to dominate the planet if your opponent makes only 2. And to get people to think in those time scales is important if we care about what world will our children live in and their descendants.
Yeah, good point. Of course, these numbers might not always stay the same. They have fluctuated in the past. There's many different things that leads to these different numbers, variables in the economy, how socially safe is it, and stuff like that. I think even a realization that you are becoming a minority would spur on people to actually have more kids, you know, if that awareness was there. So I don't think we are demographically doomed, because there's so many things that can change. But obviously there needs to be an awareness made of this, and people need to become aware of the fact that there are people that are actually trying to make sure that we not only become a minority, but don't even exist, as you say, in 1,000 years from now. But one thing I was thinking about is it's also, some people have said that, well, when Muslims come to the West or whatever, sure, a few generations, they have that many babies, but eventually they slow down as well. There seems to be some evidence to suggest that a modern lifestyle, I guess, to a certain extent, tends to yield fewer kids than a second or third world kind of living condition, if you will. And that could very well be true. But I'm also concerned with this idea that it's going to be some kind of breeding competition where, because of this awareness kicking in, people are just going to have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids in every... I mean, we are on a finite planet at this point. We don't have space travel. We can't go out and grab new resources. Space is limited. I'm concerned with nature. I'm concerned with wildlife and these kinds of issues as well. So I also, on top of it, Jeff, don't want to see some kind of breeding competition because I think it would be horrible for those humans to live in those kind of soylent green kind of conditions in the future.
Well, unfortunately, the breeding competition is the story of life, and this won't be escapable. What I say to people is there's going to be a breeding competition. It's happening at every generation. It's what it is. That's what it is to be a reproductive life form. And so what I try to explain to people on that question is the bizarre idea that you should engage in the breeding competition, that you should not let the breeding competition be won by your opponent. And that as you do so, you might bring more reasonable people into the future who might bring solutions other than just make babies all the time and do it in a sort of uncontrollable fashion. Yeah. Now, it's a tough sell, but we will not stop this human growth to the point where we will bump on the environmental limits of the planet. That is absolutely certain. Our exponential growing rate of population for the last 1,000 years is not maintainable. We are headed toward a brick wall at 1,000 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, definitely.
There's no way we stop this.
Four billion Africans by the end of the century. You know, how is that sustainable? You know,
the only thing you can do is make sure that when we reach that brick wall, that the remains of your explosion as your car bumps on it, that the remains will contain some of your descendants.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you should aim for.
Yeah, I mean, the future is interesting that way, too, because we don't know where things will go, both with, you know, automation, robotics, genetics, artificial intelligence. There's so many things that are in the works right now where basically it might not be, JF, a situation where, you know, more is better. There could be something to quality as opposed to quantity, if I can put it that way, which, of course, kind of takes us back to the RK selection theory a little bit, and it could be that if you just have the right people, if you will, that's going to be the more important things in the future, because even warfare, even if it leads to these horrible things on a racial basis or on an ethnic basis in the future, then there's no telling what kind of technologies will be at our disposal. And it might simply be IQ and strategy that's more important and not just a numbers game. That's a possibility too.
Yeah, and my book is a little bit about this, about the future technologies that will interfere with our reproduction. And if it was hard to convince people to care about immigration and what will be the impact over 1,000 years, my book is an even tougher sell.
Yeah.
It's not out yet, but the first chapter is out. It's about caring about the fact that we are about to take the first step into a phenomenon that I call phenotypic revolution. And this first step will lead to an uncontrollable drive forward, which will eventually result in the extinction of everything DNA-based on Earth. We are about to replace ourselves with a computer-based life form. And we don't need to do much to make the irreversible step. All we need is one baby to be modified genetically by a computer. And then we've started a chain of events that will deploy over potentially tens of thousands of years, but most likely over 1 million years, which will eventually kill all DNA-based life forms on Earth, which will be replaced by a life form that actually cultivates humans as farm animals. And it might sound like a long shot, but I assure people that this is what will happen if we start modifying ourselves genetically. There will be another entity taking control of the cycle of reproduction of humans to the point where it will create human puppets that will serve that separate entity, which will most likely be a computer.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. I've been thinking about this question for a long time. And it could, I guess, be argued even that the human in its current form is possibly going to be a very different thing than that kind of human that evolves out of the merger with technologies and robotics and computer brains interfaces and this kind of stuff. Maybe even artificial intelligence will have something to do with that in the future. So it could be, even though it's going to be through the hands of other humans, it might not be in the way that we think of a human today. That might be the army, if you will, that actually deploys against the few normal humans that are left. But it's a scary concept. It's also very uncertain. Like, is this really going to happen? How it's going to be pulled off, whatever. But I don't doubt it as a possible scenario for how the future will turn out. We just don't know what an artificial intelligence, how it will relate to us. We don't also know who's going to be able to program it, who's going to control it. Or are there going to be backdoors? Is it going to be an accident that somehow when the singularity occurs and this artificial intelligence runs amok and decides to kill all humans, that there are some of humans out there that have written, has a backdoor into it and say, well, preserve these people or this group or something. We don't know, right?
Yeah, there could be proxy wars. Most importantly, what keeps us evolving and what keeps us toward the right direction to protect our own existence is the fact that we have mutations appearing in our DNA. And when we reproduce, these mutations get selected. Some of them will make your children act worse for their own survival. Some of them will make your children act better for their own survival. And the theory of evolution is merely the fact that the mutations that make you act better for your own survival end up surviving. And those that make you act worse for your own survival end up dying. And that's why we are super evolved machine. We have legs and arms and eyes that beat any technology that we currently can develop. And the reason is that these have all evolved as the best solution that was available compared to its competitors. And that's why we succeeded at making babies that were viable. Now, the problem when you start delegating your mutations to a computer, when you start going to a clinic and say, hey, could you modify the genes of my baby so that he won't have Alzheimer, so that he'll be a little more intelligent or a little more efficient on his job? Then you start playing with the process where your own survival is not the only thing in the reproductive cycle that's being considered. The survival of the computer that makes these decisions becomes part of your reproductive success. And you've just abandoned your kind of independence as a life form, and you've delegated a part of the choices to another entity. Now, at that point, the problem, and that's the problem of phenotypic revolution, is that this entity can make decisions that favor its own existence over yours.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what's the possibility that something like this even becomes sentient in the sense that it will start caring for its own existence and continued future survival? I mean, I think we're still somewhat far away from that process. I know that some people are talking. I think even Elon Musk is talking. He said, I see some of the stuff that goes on in research laboratories. He knows some people working on AI. And he claims, among others, people to say that we're way further ahead than people actually think. But, I mean, do you think it's far away still to come to that stage? Or are we close to developing something like that?
The problem is that's the problem of phenotypic revolution. They don't need a sentient being. Because the moment you let the computer decide your genes, it's an evolutionary being. And it doesn't matter if he doesn't have plans or sentience. True. Now what matters is how much humans can a given clinic or a given computer modify. And then you end up with the problem that these computers, they're actually going to improve humans. So at first they're gonna solve Alzheimer's disease. They're gonna make you live for 1,000 years. They're gonna make you more intelligent. Everything's gonna be better.
This is how they're gonna sell it, man. You know.
Yeah. And now you're gonna have competition between computers because some computers will just be better. They will be made by corporations that know more about the human genome. Some of them will be better. Now you're starting to have evolutionary interest dividing not humans but dividing computers that produce humans. And now you're starting to have a life form in the computer. Now, that's why the computer evolves. It's because it creates better and better recommendations that make better and better humans. Now, that's a point at which you might argue that it's actually good. And in fact, a phenotypic revolution is not bad until the end. It's always good. It makes better humans. Now, the problem is that at some point, a computer will realize, and it will not realize consciously, but it will realize this through evolutionary step, that you can make more efficient humans by stripping them of their own self-care. You can make humans that will bring back the money to the clinic, reproduce at that clinic, favor the existence of the computer that makes the recommendation, without them having self-preservation feelings, without them looking for the perfect sexual partners. And so you're going to have a simplification of human cognition by these computers, because let's not forget that all of the complexity of the emotion systems we have currently has resulted from the fact that we are self-interested. It wouldn't be there if we were just puppets for another thing. The reason we all carry super complex brains is that our genes wanted to have decision-making on the fly like this available at all times, with the emotions and ego and love that we can feel. There's no reason a computer would maintain that in a human being.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, that's a good point, you know. And also, of course, the moment we enter onto that path, effectively the things that not only make us human, but the things that, how do I put this, that nature has designed in us as a driving, as a self driving entity, that goes out the window and that's gone. And effectively, we're on the path of genetic death at that point. But it could still continue for a very long time. It could go for thousands of years. And as you say, although it's a better human being, more efficient or faster or, you know, computational wise or smarter or intelligent wise or no diseases or whatever, it goes back into a philosophical question where we have to ask, well, what is the value of human life, and what is the purpose, right? I mean, that's really at the root of this. If you just mechanize the process of efficiency of human existence, it's like that the very existence itself is void. There's no soul, there's no drive, there's no variables for mistakes left in there anymore. It's quite scary to me, to be honest.
Absolutely, and it comes back to the point we did about immigration. We have to decide what the world will be. There's no reason why DNA is better than a computer-based program, but there's also no reason why the computer-based program is better than DNA. We've been evolving for 4 billion years based on DNA, and we can decide that planet Earth is for DNA-based humans. It's a decision. I will not deceive you into telling you that this is the truth and that science tells you you should do that, but I'm going to tell you, you can choose that. You can choose that our planet is for us by us.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very interesting. I mean, this opens a whole can of worms, JF, in terms of, you know, where things are going to go in the future, who's going to control those things. We're right at the cusp, we're right at the a fork, if you will, almost in the road of what direction we're going to take. And I'm still a firm believer in that. All the people who would consciously stay outside of these methods that many are beginning to employ now, although they will end up behind, so to speak, that might not be as fast, that might not have almost the telepathic abilities to connect to the internet, for example, or something like that, whatever is coming here, these emerging technologies. But I still think that those humans that makes a conscious choice and says, you know, okay, I'm not a Luddite, I'm not going to like not use computers or whatever, the internet, but at some point we draw the line where we say, you know, we say no to implantable technologies, for example, or we say no to hooking up to the web or to some kind of global brain or something like that. I think those people are going to be better off at the end of this than those who are entering into this kind of transhumanist state. But I don't think it's unstoppable. It's unstoppable. It's going to happen, it feels like.
Yeah, my big fear is that the people who make this choice will end up being disadvantaged evolutionarily. They will have less babies as a consequence, and they will eventually get outfluted by the better humans. That's why we have to make the decision now, because that's why I say that phenotypic revolution are an irreversible step if just one human does it. Because if that one human improves his life and the life of his descendants, we're going to be faced with millions of descendants of that person making the same decision that he did, trusting computers to control the genetics of his baby. Yeah. So that's why the decision must happen within the next few decades, because we are at one technical... What technical development away from modifying a human baby to remove a disease?
Yeah.
And once this starts, it's over.
Yeah. And there, and then, of course, you're not going to stop with that. You're going to say, well, you can improve this now. You can improve that. You can do this, that. And but we also, this is interesting, we also don't know the consequences of this. We have not cracked the secret code to life. We don't know. I mean, there's even people who are talking about junk DNA, right? There's just this bunch of shit in there. We don't even know what it is. We could take that out probably, right? I mean, they haven't, we don't know everything. We don't know what these, how these variables contribute. We don't know exactly what these processes are or these amino acids. And I don't think you can just go in and edit things. Take the example with the fruit fly, for example, where scientists successfully engineered away the eyes of the fruit fly. But I think it was within 3 or 4 generations again, maybe it was even shorter, the eyes returned back. There was like an imprint. I know that there's one scientist who's a little bit more kind of on the esoteric end of things, talking about the morphogenetic field, that there's basically like there is a blueprint that's kind of that the biological organisms work towards achieving. So even if you would go and edit things in the code, you would have to continuously be in there and edit every new generation, because it would just revert back to its original natural state.
Yeah, and concerning what we don't know, it's true that we don't know much, but my book will be a great step forward in understanding how the first replicator of a form of life emerges. Because the shocking thing is that I discovered this theory about the future while thinking about the past. Because what we know now at this point is that DNA, 4 billion years ago, the molecule that carries our genes and that has been carried the genes of all of our ancestors for 4 billion years, this molecule was produced by another life form. It was an experiment by a previous life form, and the previous life form lost control of it. That's how it became the next layer of our genetic code. But the previous life form that existed on Earth 4 billion years ago did not use DNA. It used another molecule to carry its genome. That other molecule was RNA. It was like a kind of 1.0 version of DNA, which would be the 2.0 version. And that's what happens when life forms start delegating to an external entity the creation of the genes of their babies. The external entity takes over. We are the external entity because we are DNA, but we're about to create another external entity.
It's interesting, 4 billion years ago. So what do you think happened there? What was that a conscious change or what? Random?
In my book, it could be conscious, but most of scientists would think that it was not conscious. What happened is that the previous life form, which was probably a very microscopic life form, started producing DNA. And for some reason, the production of DNA was good for that life form. There are many hypotheses. Maybe DNA was a virus. Maybe it was a way to dump the genetic information to send the molecule of DNA to another organism. And because it was DNA, because it was such a new thing at that time, it would thwart the defenses of the life forms. So maybe it was an incognito way of penetrating organism. It could also be that simply the old life form liked DNA better because DNA was more stable. Maybe it was good storage. Maybe it survived some cold temperatures or hot temperatures better than RNA. Whatever it is, DNA, for some reason, was a good way to store genes temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
And then the life form said, okay, I have my genes stored in that DNA strand. Now I'm going to produce babies from that DNA strand. I won't produce babies from self-replication anymore. And that's where DNA took over. DNA started being a better producer of the ancient life form than the ancient life form itself. And baby making was now relying on an external media. The external media became its own life form, started self-reproducing, making fake babies of the ancient life forms, saying, oh yeah, I'm gonna keep producing your RNA babies here, but I'm gonna make them in a certain way. And what do we know? 4 billion years later, DNA has totally enslaved the RNA life form and is in fact using it in every piece of your body. Still, as of today, DNA has not won its independence. In every cell of your body, all that DNA does is create fake RNA puppets that it uses to accomplish its task.
Well, yeah, what was the book? The Selfish Gene, right? That is like, it's the genetic, it's the code itself. Not maybe not the code, but the amino acids that make it up, the makeup of the genes is what's driving us. And it's actually using us for its own selfish interest. But we think it's like, no, it's me and my consciousness and we're doing things. And I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. It's very interesting.
It's the nucleotides, just to correct you, not the amino acids that form the genetic code, but
right.
You got the idea, right?
Yeah.
It's manipulating us, but importantly, the nucleotides of DNA are manipulating RNA. But RNA used to be a selfish gene, but it got fucked over by DNA in ways that are so vicious, I cannot even find the words. It's the most vicious idea I've ever had in my mind.
It's like a virus almost in a way or something.
A virus is like a schoolgirl to the process of phenotypic revolutions.
Well, it's led to us. No matter what actually is at the fundamentals of driving us, it's a fantastic, I don't know what to call it, experience to be part of, obviously. And I want to see a lot more of it. I want to preserve those different aspects that DNA has kind of manifested, if you will. It's great. This sounds like an awesome book. So tell us a little bit more and when you think, you know, when it's going to be out. You're self-publishing, you told me earlier. That's the way to go these days.
Self-publishing.
Yep.
Yeah, because you don't gain anything by being on the mainstream editor lines right now. And if you make your own media like me, in fact, you will just lose money by delegating to an editor house. So I will be publishing in a few months. It's a complete theory. It's a new theory that adds to the selfish gene. I call it an unauthorized sequel of the selfish gene, because Richard Dawkins was really brilliant he was almost prescient in announcing the theory of phenotypic revolution, but he could not see the last word that it needed. My book will simply be the last word on the question of the emergence of life. It will explain exactly how life emerged on Earth. The answer is fascinatingly shocking. Life on Earth did not emerge in a random pond. DNA-based life did not appear out of random collisions of atoms.
Mm-hmm.
DNA life was created by another life, and we're about to create another life form too.
Well, this is the thing, and there's a classic sentence or quote that people have said regarding how us also as humans came along, but even talking about biological organisms overall, and they said for the genetic code that we see it to have been an accident, so to speak, would be, what did they say? That would have been like a tornado going through a junkyard and accidentally like building a jumbo jet or something like that. It's so complex. It's so difficult to do something like this that it had to almost have been a conscious effort, if you will, to try to do that. And I don't know where I stand on that, but I'm certainly not ready to throw that outside of the window because it's so complex. It's so just amazing when you begin to understand what it really is and how it operates, how it works, and the complexity of it, right?
Yeah, well, there's two arguments why you should abandon that view that it could have been made by a complex being. It's that first, you would create a complex being, and that complex being would operate based on complex operations. So you would be found with the same problem, which is to explain what led to God being so complex, or
sure.
What led to that complex being so complex.
Yeah.
And the fact that the theory of evolution gives you the tools, all the tools that you need to explain how something goes from being a little atom in a pound of water, just making copies of itself, how this can build into a whole deer, a lion, a beetle, or a human being.
Yeah. So where's the first chapter if people want to check out? Did you make a video on it or is it available on your site?
Yeah, so if you want the chapter, it's book.jfg.world. You can go on my site and you will get a link. You can also go on some of my videos. I explain the ideas in video form. So essentially, there's nothing that's not exposed yet to the public, but it's all in broken down videos. So the book will just be a more poetic exploration of the scientific ideas that I've developed for 7 years now.
All right. Very interesting. Well, I'd love to have you back, Jay, at that point and talk more about the book, help you plug it, of course, when it's out. We can go into some of the things that we didn't have time to kind of go into today. Sounds fascinating. Very interesting work you're involved in. I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. We need more people like you, obviously, to be out there and be vocal about the truth and what it is and biology overall and the reality of race is a very important question, I think, for the sake of diversity and all that kinds of stuff. So is there anything you'd like to, leave us with or something you want to plug? Obviously, people should check out your YouTube channel. That's where you seem to be most active, but you're on Gab and Twitter and all these places as well. But let us know if there's something you want to kind of leave the audience with before we
end. Yeah, I'm all good. I really enjoyed the conversation with you. I have nothing to add. I would simply say what I've already said, which is don't forget that we can talk about how we want the world to be. And we should be having a discussion right now about how we want the world to be. And there is no answer that is wrong. We should just discuss it and we should agree on something. And discussion, the first step of discussion is to recognize the humanity of the people you interact with. They're not Nazis. They're not evil people with intentions that they don't display. Let's have a conversation. We have the internet. It's the first time in the history of civilization where everyone can join that conversation. Don't miss it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, JF. Really appreciate it. Let's have you back soon, okay?
Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching or listening today. A big thank you to all our members who make our Altmedia platform possible. Without you, we could not do this. So a big thank you to everyone who's donated to us, be that cryptos or fiat. Everything is welcome. It helps us grow. Also, check out getting a membership at redicemembers.com if you have not already. If you like our content, you'll love the members' website. Tons of exclusive stuff there for you, but all our radio shows, our full archives, videos, Weekend Warrior, tons of the other shows that we produce as well. But just overall, guys, it's good to be back. It's a new year. We'll be back at full speed here once again. More shows coming up, more videos, exclusive stuff for members is coming up as well. Thank you for all the kind emails and the messages of support. Have an awesome start to your 2018. Looking forward to bringing you a lot more this year as we continue to grow. Just one more thing before we let you go. Remember, don't take us for granted. YouTube has put many of our videos in quarantine just the last week. We have that Labour politician in Britain that has requested that representatives from YouTube specifically look at our channel, look at Red Ice TV, to take it down. She wants us booted off the platform. So don't take us for granted. Obviously, subscribe to our YouTube channel, get our alerts, all that good stuff. But don't just visit the YouTube channel. Go to our websites, redice.tv and redicemembers.com, as a way to get our content. If we're kicked off and YouTube is the only place you're getting our stuff, you won't be getting it anymore, I'm sad to say. So we are looking to get onto alternative platforms where we can continue to have our content in addition to YouTube. But all our content is always going to be available at redicemembers.com. No one's going to pull videos or censor videos from our own platform. Until next time, take care, stay strong, everybody. Have a good day.